Can you imagine there are people that support this center in a very physical and practical way that we hardly even know? Isn't it wonderful to be cared about so much? So I, for one, am really grateful. And so for that reason, I'm going to deliver a really exciting message today. Are you ready? Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. The title of the message is The Test. And I want you to think, before you leave today, to think differently about what it means to be tested. And so the quotation that I found from Dr. Ernest Holmes, who is the founder of this teaching, this philosophy, this way of life, Dr. Holmes wrote in our Science of Mind textbook this these words: All demonstrations. A demonstration is a manifestation. It's an answered prayer. It's anything that we call into form. All demonstrations take place within ourselves. The law is always working from that inner pattern. We do not struggle with conditions. We use principle to move through conditions. Every individual must make the test in his or her own soul. Right? So it is we ourselves who are given this opportunity to live our lives, to experience real life conditions, which apparently Bill has experienced a real life condition. I think it was actually a fun thing that went awry. Was it the ocean that did this to you? It was fun. He's good. There he's standing on it. And not only that, but you are already healed, my darling. And so what we know is that we are always testing ourselves. And I wanted to look at that idea then of what does it mean to say that we are testing our own soul. Would you like to explore that question with me today? Yes. Let's find out what it means to test our own soul. Now, one of the core beliefs that we stand in as we teach this philosophy, in fact, this is what unifies all of New Thought, all the different segments of different religious beliefs that are connected to New Thought have this in common, and that is that we believe in wholeness, that we teach wholeness as a spiritual principle. And what that means is that we all live in this great, big, beautiful universe where everything comes together and works in perfect order. There is some way that the planets know how to stay in perfect orbit. There is some way that the Earth spins on its axis at exactly the exact miles per hour that it moves around that would be dizzying to think about, and yet the universe has those things all worked out. We don't have to think about gravity or the cycles of the seasons or any of that. We don't work to keep our body healthy. We work to reveal the truth of the natural order, the wholeness that already exists within the human body as well as the entire universe. So there is something perfect about us. Now, this connects to our idea how some religions teach that we are born in sin, that there's something imperfect that we have to overcome, and the experience of life is to overcome that, and we don't stand aligned to that. We believe sort of the opposite of that, that it is beautiful and miraculous the way we are born as perfect as we are, and it is our gift of choice to continue to reveal how wonderful and beautiful and gorgeous that the human being can be as we align our consciousness to these higher ideas, to these greater truths. So we're not born in sin, but we are born in this extravagant potential for whatever it is we desire to exhibit in our living. And then we piggyback that idea of wholeness with oneness. So they're kind of two different ideas, but they take us back to the same understanding. So there is only one God, One mind. It is the mind of God. It is the infinite intelligence of all the universe. It created all things. That mind is my mind now. And that mind is your mind now. And so as we remember that and we open up to it, yeah, good job. You guys are all, give yourself a little pat in the back. See how fun this could be? So as we remember that, we're more likely to shine in the way that we are created to shine. So in the Judeo-Christian written text, the Bible, there's a place where it says, "Hear, O Israel, one." There is one God. There is one mind. There is one truth. And in that writing, we're beginning to understand, especially when we're willing to look at a deeper meaning of it other than just any particular religious view. We come together to realize that when we talk about that kind of oneness, we are talking about that undivided wholeness. We are talking about this idea of a unification, a connection, a oneness of all of life. Everything together in that oneness. So it is on this premise that we stand and that we teach this philosophy, and then we begin to understand that if we believe that, which we do, right? And if we align our living to that belief, then what happens is we have to begin to notice how much faith we have in the opposite of that, so that we can start getting rid of that. We don't need any beliefs in the opposite of that. If God is good, then life is good. So what the beauty of this teaching is, and I say this a lot, is that we don't give any credibility to an opposing force to God called Satan the devil. Mm-mm, not in my life. I've lived that religion. I had a lot of faith in the devil once and was certain that he was trying to get me. And the way that we teach that is very simple in the basics of the foundational ideas of the science of mind, that if there is God, this mighty force that created all things, and if there is an equal and opposing force, Satan the devil, then they would cancel each other out. It's mathematics 101. Entry-level math. So as we look at this idea that there is really no devil, maybe it's possible there's no devil, there's no evil influence that's sitting on your shoulder constantly trying to trick you into eating some kind of fruit, right? That we are just given all. Life is this big, beautiful banquet, and we get to choose what we want, what parts of it we want to partake in. And so it shows up in our lives in a variety of different ways because we're each individually unique in the way that we have been created. So let's talk about that creation story in the Judeo-Christian scripture. You know, there's this divine couple, Adam and Eve, that were created and given this glorious place to live. They called it the Garden of Eden. You've heard of it, right? You don't have to be religious to know this story. And so Adam and Eve are given everything they need to not only live in this gorgeous place, but that they are entitled to thrive, that all of their needs are met, that they will not want for anything, and they will live forever in this happy, fulfilling setting. Paradise. Except for one problem. It wasn't that somebody put up a parking lot. It was that, Dorothy, you're so inspiring. It was that there was one rule. Now, we don't like rules very much, and they only had one rule. And the rule was that they could have all of this except for that tree over there. Don't touch that tree, and by all means, don't eat of the fruit of that tree. And so The story is colorful and is interpreted in all sorts of ways. You know, a serpent came and asked Eve, who told you you can't eat that? Come on, you know what's going to happen. That's a tree of the knowledge of good and bad. If you eat the fruit of that tree, you're going to have all that same knowledge that God has. And apparently that sounded pretty good to her, and she talked the man into it, and then they ate the fruit, and then, of course, they get caught, and God says, who told you you were naked? And then he says, she made me do it. And then she says, he, the snake, it wasn't my fault. And voila, we have the devil tempting. And, the whole thing goes downhill from there. So the idea that most of us have been given through religions of many varieties is that if you break that one rule, if you eat the fruit from that tree, you are going to now lose all that goodness that you were entitled to, and now you're going to experience hardship, that you're going to notice that a lot of those plants in that pretty garden have thorns, and you're going to experience difficulties and pain, and life isn't going to be very much fun anymore. But of course, we're assured everything will work out in the end if we follow a new set of rules. So the main point is that once we taste that fruit, where we see now a difference between good and evil, we can never go back. You can never be restored and get that image out of your mind, so to speak. Your life will never quite be the same. Your eyes have been opened to experience contrast. Now, some people, I was thinking about this. Sometimes it's really funny to be in my mind because I was thinking, you know, that some people, all right, a lot of times it's funny to be in my mind. But I was thinking that a lot of people would say, I guess you could say, I don't know about a lot of people, but I was thinking you could say that the story implies that we're better off living in ignorance. But that's not what the story is saying. In fact, I want to tell you, I believe that we have missed the entire point of the story, because I believe this experience of Adam and Eve in a garden and there's a tree, it's just a story, you know? It's just a legend. It's a myth. But there's this idea that they lived in this place, and I believe that the main point of the story really is that they had a choice to make. And they made their choice, and then there are consequences that come from each and every choice that we make. It's the basic explanation of the law of cause and effect. You reap what you sow, what goes around comes around, you eat of the fruit, you're going to get that processed in you, and that's going to be a part of now who you have become based on a choice that you made. Can you feel I'm getting somewhere? Yeah. All right. We have the same choice. Only what I want to say is we have that choice every single day. And this is not bad news. It's like every day we're born in the garden and everything is perfect and everything we need it'll be provided for us. But we have a choice. And we get up and we're tempted to taste the fruit. And we turn on the TV and we see contrast. We see good and we see evil and we get confused and we start thinking that that's the reality of life. And life is so much more. Life is so much more. But the truth is that we do get to decide what we believe. We do, we are born with this bias to notice what we like and what we don't like. I hear you tell me what you like and what you don't like about a lot of things around here. And what's always amusing to me is that you don't even agree with each other on what's the right thing for each of those things we talk about. If you don't believe me, come sit on the board for a term. Or believe me and come sit on the board for a term. That would be nice too. Next year we'll be needing some new faces. So we start living in contrast, and we really have that idea that we can't go back again because we're just married to the excitement of contrast. And I think there's beauty in contrast. But instead of seeing beauty in contrast, we name it good or bad. We make decisions. What are the right things and acceptable things to do and not do, or say or don't say? And then we carry our own sort of book of rules around with us, believing that our rules, if they work for us, they should work for everybody. And then life is a big surprise if you think everybody's going to agree with you, because it doesn't quite turn out that way. And so what happens is we separate ourselves from the whole. Right? We sort of have stepped out of the wholeness in our uniqueness and in valuing our life and our individual way of viewing different situations. And we become like Adam and Eve, and we feel tested, except that we are only testing ourselves. See, I love all this because when life gets wacky, I love it just as an invitation. Well, Reverend Minister here, why don't you just sit down and ask yourself what you really believe about all of this? Because that always takes me back to center. That grounds me in my spiritual truth yet again so that I can have a higher answer other than just the stuff that's unfolding in this ongoing Adam and Eve story and this ongoing temptation to eat the fruit and notice the differences. So the Adam and Eve story implies that there's this lifelong test, which could easily be that devil sitting on your shoulder, or in spiritual terms, sometimes we clean it up and call it the ego. But what I want to say is, it's you. You get to test your soul in just the way you decide you're willing to test your soul or not. You don't have to do any of it if you don't want to. But don't be showing up on Thursday to talk with Reverend Cheryl. I'm just saying. We all get to choose what we desire to experience. Am I right? All right. And so now, in addition, are you with me, Reverend Cheryl? Okay, good, good. And so this is not just a Judeo-Christian story. You know, every religion and spiritual tradition has their own variation of the creation story and how things get to be the way they are. And that's what religion is supposed to do. Religion is supposed to give us those answers or ways of dealing with the predicaments we see in our life or in the world. But you know who else has a story very similar to that is the Buddhists. Buddhists have this story of Siddhartha. Siddhartha is a child born into a wealthy home. He lives at the palace with his family, and his father loves him so much, he wants nothing more than to protect him from knowing what's going on outside the walls of the palace. So he keeps the wall built very high, and he's going to protect his son so that his son can feel the richness of life as he so deserves. And then one day, you know, that it will only work for so long. One day, I think it's his birthday, and he wants to ride on the back of an elephant. And so his father brings in an elephant with an elephant mahout. Is that what you call the elephant keeper that just went? Did I do that right, honey? Okay, it's a mahout. He brings in a mahout with his elephant. Every elephant has a single trainer, and that's who the mahout is. At least in Thailand. And so then he brings him in, and the boy wants to ride on the back of the elephant, and then he gets taller than the wall, and he can see what's on the other side. And what does he see? He sees the contrast. He's tasted the fruit. He sees that people age, and that there's illness, and that there's pain, and he will never be the same. And so this new vision, in the case of Siddhartha, who's a very spiritual being, what he's witnessed, puts him out on this lifelong journey. He wants to make sense of it. He wants to go out and see if he can make sense of all these things that exist in the world that he didn't know were there. And he sets out on an adventure of discovery. Wants to make sense of sickness and poverty and death. And so he dabbles in all kinds of spirituality and religious experiences. In fact, he dabbles in some pretty worldly experiences. And so he's been an ascetic where he nearly starves himself to death in the name of something that's greater than he is. And then he goes to the other extremes and he enjoys the worldly pleasures. And none of it makes sense until he stops. He stops eating the fruit every day. He stops looking at the differences. And he sits. Still. Be still and know. And so what happens? He becomes awakened. He sits under this Bodhi tree or whatever, and he becomes the awakened one. And so what he learns, what we can learn from this story is that there are ultimately ways for us to experience a broader view of life without sequestering ourselves away from the things that don't feel comfortable in life. Beyond the palace walls, there's more. And so where do we build walls in our own life to sort of protect us from the difficult things that are going on in the world? Where in our life are we tasting the fruit with a lot of regularity and consistency in noticing the differences? Somewhere in between is what the Buddha found. Buddha named it compassion. And then hundreds of years later, Jesus comes and he has the same experience. He realizes there's more and that the people are missing the point, and he calls it love. He builds on that compassion, that spiritual truth that comes from the Buddhist story and the teachings. And he adds love to it, and he tells us that we must love one another and that we must practice forgiveness. See, I think that forgiveness is that part of spiritual teaching that teaches us to accept differences in a new way. It's not to reconcile damaged relationships if they're not supposed to be reconciled. Maybe some things happen just because there are lessons there for us. And when we get those lessons, we know how to show up slightly differently so that they don't happen again. So I believe that as we're living in, it's noisy these days. There are some loud voices out there opposing each other. And this sort of made me laugh when I was thinking, again, you have to be in my head to laugh at it. But there are ways in which I see that those loud voices create this contrast that we can think it's either this way or that way. And the people on the extreme sides, as in life over any topic, no matter what it is, have strong opinions. But here's what I was thinking. It's like those loud voices are accusing and blaming and pointing. And if you think about it, this is how absurd it seemed to me when I was writing this talk at very odd hours. I thought, you know what's funny? It's as if this side is saying that everybody on this side is horrible because they're creating an end to the earth, the world's going to end, and poverty and sickness is going to be overwhelming, and all the bad things are going to happen because of this side. And this side is saying the very same thing about this side. And the truth is, everybody wants the same thing. Everybody wants the same thing. Just like me. I want to feel safe at night. I want to have enough to eat. I want a little dark chocolate sometimes. Okay, maybe not that. But just like me. Everybody has that same desire to experience good, to feel comfortable, to have joy, to be able to see beauty and recognize the divine order of the universe that is always working no matter what else is going on. Do you ever notice that? A tragedy happens somewhere, But the rest of the world is just going on, business as usual. Because that's life. That is the insistence on life to keep living. And you cannot change that. I can't change that. We can't put a prayer group together to stop it. A group of satanic followers can't stop it. It's life. It's just the way life exists. So never forget that no matter how grim things look on the surface, that there are millions, and I say this with tremendous confidence, there are millions of people praying at the exact same time that you are for the exact same good to come to the world, to have the exact same experience of goodness that you desire to have in your own life. There are millions of us. But you can't hear us on the surface over the loud voices shouting out at each other. It does not mean that the goodness is missing or limited. So here's the deal. Think about something you, don't say it out loud, but think about something in your life that you really believe in, that you are willing to take a stand for. And everybody should have something. If you don't, you probably should be Buddhist, because they approve of that. I don't. And if you know what it is that you would stand for, that you might even say you would argue for, it's okay. You can argue, right? In the name of good. Then as we stand in that truth, remember that anybody that doesn't agree with your truth, now it appears they are on an opposing side. But they are only really on an opposing side if we name it that. Right? We can disagree, and that doesn't mean that we oppose each other. And so be very careful about how you stand in what you believe. Do you hear me? I really mean this. I feel like a mother. I feel like, be very careful in how you stand in your posture, in your body language, in the way you breathe, in the way you live your life. Be very choosy about how you stand, because if you do not, you may be demonizing someone who lives on the other side of the thought than you are, right? And so it is true, as Jesus said, we have the power to heal the sick, to raise the dead, and to cast out demons. And so I'm going to give you a little lesson in casting out demons. I think we all need to know this stuff just in case, right? So would you like a lesson in how to cast out demons? Well, I don't know. Maybe you don't. Do you want a lesson in casting, how to cast out demons? Of course you do. Nobody wants demons in their life. You know where I'm going, right? If you want to cast out demons, quit demonizing anything that is different in your life or from your life. Take an action and choose to see what's working. Choose to see what's the same. Choose to remember wholeness and that interconnectedness of all of life, and let people have their own opinions. If you want to cast out demons, quit demonizing. So we're studying Emma Curtis Hopkins on Wednesdays. We're almost done. I'm so sad. I think we need to go another round, another 6 weeks. We're studying Emma Curtis Hopkins, and she's got some strong opinions on how to cast out demons, that woman. That she knows how to say it like it is. This is probably where I got this idea. And I think as I study her, she writes a lot of metaphorical. She's a mystic, so you can't just read it. You got to like embody it. And Emma Curtis Hopkins says, basically, I'll sum it up in my own language: if you want to cast out demons, you got to go on a new diet. You got to eat differently. You got to quit eating from that fruit where you see good and bad, where you see right and wrong, where you think there's a certain way to do it, and anybody that opposes your idea now becomes your enemy. We cast out demons by not making demons just because somebody's different. Right? It's a new diet.
Truth diet.
Truth diet. I was going to say paleo, but it's clearly a high protein if you can't eat the fruit. I don't know. I'm just thinking. All right, so how do we do that? We do that by studying wholeness. We do that by sitting ourselves in an environment where we get some ideas that can change our thinking so that we can change our lives. We focus on calling forward wellness instead of harboring and worrying about sickness. We do that by understanding that the human body itself has an inclination to heal, to reveal wholeness, to be strong and vibrant and healthy, rather than looking at appearances in the way that Jesus would talk about that. We rejoice in the revealing of our health, thriving in life in the best way. And we raise the dead every time we realize the consistency of life, that there is no death. There is a shedding. There is a shedding which reveals more aliveness. When this doesn't work anymore, there's still lots of life, and we let go of that which is holding us back. Yes, there are seasons. When my father was living with us, he flew to Chicago to spend a few weeks with my sister in the wintertime. And he insisted that big tree over there was dead, that it was not just winter, that tree out of all the other trees was a dead tree. And my sister could not convince him that it's just dormant, that tree will have life again as soon as spring comes. So spring comes. Even after something looks like there's no life left in it, spring comes, the trees bud out, the daffodils poke out their little heads, and life is full of color and lots of Twitter patience, as I said earlier. So let us stop demonizing. Let us quit accusing winter of being a death sentence for things. And let us stop making people look different than we are. And you know what? Sometimes that means we have to let up and not we have to quit trying to be so different. Oh, I'm really different. I say that all the time. I was in the fourth or fifth grade, and I wrote a 40-page story for at school, and it was called "I Was Different." You know, so I get it. We're all different. You know why? 'Cause we are. But in the same way that we are, but from a spiritual perspective, we're not. We're absolutely the same. So you don't have to give up anything to be unique. Sometimes I see we fight for our uniqueness. You don't have to fight for it. You are it. Just own it, claim it, be it. And quit making demons. It's just really a test, but it is a test of love. And here's what I really love about it. I was thinking this. It's just a yes or no question. You know, at any given moment, it's like, are you in now? You can answer yes or you can answer no. But we can always return to love if we choose to do that. I have a quote from Aldous Huxley, a British author, philosopher. He said, evil is that which makes for separation. Evil is that which makes for separation. See, when we see anything that seems to disagree with the way we want it or like it or expected it to be, we have now separated ourselves. It is a test of our own soul. And so there's a way that, you know, I mean, it is, on one hand, it's sort of natural that we have that tendency to see people that look different than us, and then we get a little insecure that maybe we're not doing it right, and then we move into defending ourselves a little. That's why when I was a kid, there were Pollock jokes, right? Ooh, did that make you a little uncomfortable? I know. And then there were moron jokes, and then there were jokes about anybody that was the newest immigrant into the country. There were Irish jokes, and there were Asian jokes, and then Austin Powers came and said he blamed it on the damn dirty Dutch just to make fun of everybody else for making fun of others, right? You see what happens? There's always somebody that's lower on the totem pole, and it's human nature that we can't help it. We're just trying to feel better about ourselves, because today, today we're a little more politically correct, so we don't tell those jokes, at least, you know, not to each other here, I hope. But you know what we do tell? Blonde jokes. Blonde jokes, we still tell blonde jokes. Now, I have been in circles where somebody told a blonde joke and got in trouble for it because there were several blondes in the room. But I got to thinking, what is it about, you know, because we're looking for a nicer way to do it, so we blamed it all on the blondes. And I thought, I wonder what this is about. So you know me, I went straight to Google. I wanted to know, what does Wikipedia have to say about blonde jokes? Why do we make fun of blonde women? You know, so would you like to know what I found in my research? According to Wikipedia, blonde jokes are a class of jokes based on stereotyping the dumb blonde woman. It goes on to say that currently we are experiencing an emergence of a class of meta jokes about blondes. You know what that means? Blondes are getting back. Blondes are now, they're countering those jokes. And it also said, blonde jokes are considered offensive to many, which would explain perhaps some of your uncomfortableness right now. However, in mainstream media, such as newspapers and television, they still seem to be acceptable. And then, I swear to you this is true, you can look at my notes later if you don't believe me, or Google it yourself. Then it gave a sample of a blonde joke in Wikipedia. Now, I want to, with my whole heart, I want to tell you how this blonde joke, it's so funny. But I can't do that because I want, of course, to be politically correct. So I changed it. I cleaned it up. And so now it's not about blondes, but it is about aging, slightly naive, New Thought ministers that wear great shoes. Now I can tell you this joke about aging, slightly graying New Thought ministers that wear great shoes. So here's the setting. The minister is at a comedy show, and the entertainer is a ventriloquist. This is the important part of the story. She's watching a comedian that's a ventriloquist, and he's, you know, I don't know what he looks like. Make it up in your own mind. And halfway through, he is like bashing gray-haired ministers that wear great shoes through the whole comedy act. And so halfway through, she can't take it anymore. And she stands up in the middle of the crowd. She stands up and she says, stop right there. I have heard enough of your stupid jokes about aging gray-haired New Thought ministers that wear good shoes. I've heard enough. What does any of that have to do with her worth as a human being? It's people like you that keep people like me, ministers like me, you keep us from being respected. And then not only that, but people like you continue to perpetuate discrimination against not only ministers, but of all independent thinkers. What makes you think that's okay? And the ventriloquist is stunned. Nobody has ever done this before. So he stops his act and he says, lady, I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to offend anybody. And she goes, not you, silly. I'm talking to that idiot on your knee. I know. And you know, 6 months from now, 6 years from now, people will still be saying, you know, there was a minister on a Sunday morning that told a blonde joke? But I didn't. I did not tell you a blonde joke. See, we do need to laugh a little, and I think it really is valuable for us to talk about how it's really not funny when we're making fun of somebody else. I can make fun of myself, but it really becomes not funny when we're putting down other people because there is that psychologically, that way we're just not feeling good enough about who we really are already. But so let's lighten up. Let's laugh a little. When we see differences, let's just know we've been practicing separation. And in a moment of that realization, we can pull ourselves back to truth. We can come back to that beautiful garden. You can meet me at the well right there in all of that perfection and the beauty that it is. Let us be in love together, whether we are comedians and blondes or smart people or not smart people or rich people or not rich people. None of that matters because there is only one. And in love, we are always restored to our wholeness. So let's take a breath and move from the busyness of speaking into the sacredness of prayer. And so at this time, I would invite all of the practitioners and the ministers and the ministers in training, just stand now and circle the room. Bringing that energy of the consciousness that is well prayed. And as we just review all the things that have unfolded this morning so beautifully, we know indeed there is so much to celebrate. It is this thing called life. And life is right here in this very room, in all its magnificence. I feel the love of God within me, knowing that right here and right now, the fullness of Spirit itself is here. That there is this infinite intelligence of all the universe that created every living thing from a thought. That we are here revealing our wholeness even in this very moment. Allowing ourselves to open to that higher perspective. I feel the love of God within me, and I recognize that it is that moment of union, of connection, of knowing that we are intertwined in this web of life, that we belong to each other. I feel the love of God, and I know that it is the song that we rejoice in. We allow ourselves to feel that opening as Cerise sings such beautiful words. I know it is in the prayers that we speak and the readings that are performed here. It is in the essence of the message. It is at the core of every being. And in this moment, we are quickened in the inside. Something stirs. There is that golden light of truth. And it is fanned into a glorious flame that reveals even more of our perfection. And so there's a healing going on. There is a healing happening right now because truth is being revealed to us individually, collectively, on this planet. Millions of people praying with us even now. Knowing that we do believe that there is a world that can work for all of us. That we can be choosy of what fruits we eat, what trees we pick our food from, and how we process what we see going on in the world around us. And we will not demonize what we see. We will stand in truth. We will hold our heads up in the glory of God and know that something magnificent is still unfolding. And so I say, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, Spirit. Thank you, life. How good it is to know again that no matter what, God is right here. Life is unfolding and things are coming together in a new order. life is emerging in a new way in which we have never experienced it before, and so we welcome it. We allow our love of life and our love for each other to dissipate our fears, to allow us to stand fully in our goodness, to claim our joy, our peace, our divinity. And so feeling that rushing through my body, knowing that it is the grace of God pouring and streaming into this room, and that each one of us has exactly what it is that we came here to get today, I joyfully and completely release the words of this prayer into that dynamic law that always supports our choice. We say yes to God, and God says yes to us, and so it is. Amen.